Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, why a smaller refund doesn't mean you paid higher taxes. But first to the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, wow, it feels like 3 weeks since I last talked to you in the news cycle. Oh my gosh.
It feels like 3 weeks since Friday when Donald Trump had that surreal news conference.
He did.
At the White House.
Let me play just an excerpt here from, I think, part of this press conference that we all kind of zeroed in on as he announced the national emergency. Here's the president.
But on the wall, they skimped. So I did. I was successful in that sense, but I want to do it faster. I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster.
So I would imagine, Ken, that that is going to end up being important as this goes to court or as Congress thinks about what to do next, what he just said there.
Absolutely. I didn't need to do this. Well, does that make that a national emergency? Doesn't sound like that at all. And I think he almost upended his own case by putting it that way. And if this were a national emergency, he wouldn't have spent most of that 47-minute, whatever you want to call it, on Friday, talking about how he should have the Nobel Peace Prize and why Obama was really about to have war with North Korea and we should put fentanyl users and dealers to death like China's doing. I mean, it just was like a stream of consciousness that did not sound like a national emergency. If it did, maybe it means we should have the 25th Amendment invoked.
As I understand this, Ken, what sets President Trump's national emergency declaration apart is that it reroutes money that was already allocated by Congress for something else. Other presidents have done it. As I read the analysis, it's this allocation of money for something else that seems to be different. What's your take on this?
That is absolutely correct. I mean, yes, the president and his defenders will say correctly that the presidents going back, I don't know, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, they have used national emergencies to change kind of policy. But never has a president gone to Congress, said, I want this money for X, Y, or Z. Congress said no. And then the president says, okay, I'll use the money appropriated for something else to do it for the thing I want. No president has ever done that. The only thing that comes to mind, and I'm not sure if this is even a good example, is when the Congress barred President Reagan from using money to support the Contras, and he did an end run with Iran and things like that. But that's the only thing I could ever, only time I could ever remember something like that happening.
One of the puzzling things here to try to understand this, and I know there are political calculations going on, but Mitch McConnell's position on this seems to be confusing because you read Washington journalists who say behind the scenes he's deeply concerned about the precedent of this, and he's somebody who cares about precedent. Publicly, though, he's saying he's going to support it. Will you explain to us a bit about the calculation that Mitch McConnell's making?
Well, there are many Republicans on Capitol Hill who perhaps privately will say they don't like what the president does. And I'm not even talking about this national emergency, but they know that with the president has such loyalty and such control over the votes of Republican voters out there that they're afraid to publicly contradict the president. But with Mitch McConnell, basically everything with him is a trade-off. He wants, there's been many examples, many indications that he is upset with the president with this, that it upends constitutional separation of state between the executive and the legislative branch. But he also wanted, he also felt, my understanding is that the president might not have signed the legislation to keep the government funded if he didn't get backing for this national emergency.
So, I mean, wait a minute. Just so I understand. So you're saying that McConnell didn't believe it when the president said most recently that he would support this bill? Where they had worked out the deal on the funding?
Well, there was a fear. I mean, there was and probably a legitimate fear, because the president does have the capacity to change his mind on a dime. But there was the fear that the president would not have gone along with this bill that Congress and the negotiators finally put together that would keep the another shutdown from occurring. I mean, basically with McConnell and a little bit of like Paul Ryan as well, that they feel that everything with Trump is a trade-off, that, well, I'll go along with this if I can get this, or if I can keep him from going one step further. But it's my understanding from I spoke to a New York Times journalist who knows McConnell pretty well.
Yeah.
He said that McConnell is livid about this, but yet he felt he had no choice.
You just mentioned Paul Ryan in passing there, and President Trump didn't want to name Paul Ryan by name, but it sounded like that's clearly who he was referring to when he talked about
Friday,
some people.
Right.
Yeah, some people who were in power and didn't get this done. Do you think he was talking about Ryan?
Well, you know something? I didn't think of Ryan when the journalist asked the president that during the press conference. But every analyst said afterwards that's exactly who he was talking about,
okay,
that he was frustrated that even though the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress, he still couldn't get the money he wanted for that wall.
Interesting editorial, Ken, in the Times this weekend about how the president is driving Republican voters away from the party, including younger voters. In the midst of, by the way, polling that says that he's got 78% support from Republican voters for the way he's doing the job. But here's what this editorial says. It has flown under the radar a bit, masked perhaps by the switch of millions of Obama's voters into Mr. Trump's column. But in 2016, Mr. Trump did not receive support from a large segment of voters who pulled the lever for Mitt Romney in 2012. In fact, our data shows that 5% of Romney 2012 voters stayed home in 2016, while another 5% voted for Mrs. Clinton. These voters tend to be female, non-white, younger, and more highly educated, the very voters Republicans feared would be alienated by a Trump victory when he was seeking the party's nomination. Of course, all these would-be presidents for 2020 are out there hoping to get that cohort, aren't they? These younger, non-white, independent, maybe moderate Republican voters.
That is true. Look, there's always been, throughout 2016 and in the 2 years since, there's been a sizable contingent of never-Trump Republican voters. But at the same time, we shouldn't forget that in 2016, Donald Trump got more votes than any Republican ever running for president in the primaries.
That's a good point.
So you can say, well, a lot of Romney people stayed home, a lot of McCain people stayed home, and that's true, including Romney and McCain. But the fact is, the president, Donald Trump, also brought out more Republicans that may not have voted, wouldn't have voted, had it been for anybody else other than Donald Trump.
That's what I was just going to ask you about that. So these voters come from, I usually don't engage in an election, I usually don't show up to vote, and he activated those voters. The question is, can he do it again, right, in 2020?
Well, that's a very good question. We saw that his inability to pull many Republicans over the finish line in 2018, which happened to be a very, very good year for Democrats, certainly in the House. Now, he'll take credit for victories in the Senate, but my goodness, if you're not going to get a Republican elected in North Dakota or Indiana or in Missouri, you know, then you're in big trouble. So I mean, he had a good year. The president had a good year for the Republicans in the Senate in 2018. In 2020, there's not too many Republicans in the Senate who are vulnerable either. And so for all the Democrats who are hoping that maybe we could pick up the Senate in 2020, that doesn't look likely either. But at the same time, we should say that nobody thought that the Democrats were going to win back the House before redistricting would take hold after 2020. And the fact that they did it 2018, there could be more anti-Trump voters out there than the president and his party realize.
Ken, what do you think of former FBI Director Andrew McCabe's doing a series of interviews now, coming out with a book, talking about how, again, the 25th Amendment was discussed inside the FBI? Is the president, again, able to just dismiss this as naysayers and people who have been opposed to him since the very beginning? Or does it settle in, do you think, with some voters?
Well, I think both. I mean, obviously the president does feel and has felt from the beginning that there is a conspiracy in the Justice Department and the FBI out to delegitimize the president's election in 2016. And McCabe and Comey and others and Rosenstein are all part of this cabal. I mean, Lindsey Graham is now talking about bringing them before his Senate committee.
I saw that.
To ask them if there's some kind of a bureaucratic coup going on. But I think people realize, I mean, there have been a lot of tell-all books, and we've seen a lot of indications that there is serious concern in intelligence agencies, in the Justice Department, in the FBI, worried about the 45th president and a lot of questions about his fitness to lead these are not isolated instances. And so I thought the book, I mean, what he said about Jeff Sessions as well as the president, I thought was pretty remarkable.
Remind me.
Well, he said that Sessions would not have any comprehension of what conversations were going on about Justice Department issues, that he would every now and then throw in a bigoted racial comment that basically is what defeated Sessions back in 1986 when he was up for a U.S. attorney position that the Senate rejected, that a lot of the things that Sessions said about race were what his critics have been saying for years, that he has these racial, I don't want to say racist because that's pretty strong of a charge, but he has these views on race that are not basically what the rest of the country or most of the country agrees with.
McCabe also says that Rod Rosenstein offered to wear a wire inside the White House, which is mind-blowing. Yeah, what?
It is. Now, there's some question whether that was tongue-in-cheek or a joke, although the thought of wearing a wire against the president, I don't know what's funny about that. But I think Rosenstein has said that, I think, or his people have indicated that it may not have been serious. But the fact that he's talking about it, the fact that nobody believes the president, trusts the president, and is worried for about the president's capabilities is a frightening thing. And again, as you say in the premise of this conversation, something that voters will have to be aware of and pay attention to in 2020.
Ken, I'm interested in who you think the next contender is in the Democratic nomination race to jump in, given that Amy Klobuchar is headed to New Hampshire and many of the other candidates are out and about today making appearances. So who's next?
Well, my understanding is that it could be as soon as a week. Bernie Sanders, we always talk about what's going to happen with the killer bees, Bernie, Beto, and Biden. But Bernie Sanders may be the next bee to jump in the race. He has had, as have so many of the Democratic prospects, he has had not a good press lately. There was an article in the New York Times today
about
basically
that.
How African Americans have turned away from him because of opportunities he could have had in 2016 that he failed to take advantage of. There were unsettled accusations that the Sanders campaign treated women poorly during the 2016 campaign. And the fact is that, for all the money that he has raised, he is not, there are some Democrats, big D Democrats, who feel that he has not done as much for the party as he wants them to do for him, considering the fact that he is still not a member of the Democratic Party. He's still an independent.
It's interesting, Ken, when you look at the current field and you look at the demography of the current field, and then you look at candidates like Biden and Sanders, I think a natural political observer's question is, did their moment pass? I mean, are we seeing, this next generation of rising Democratic policy leaders and just leaders in general?
That's a great question. And the reason it's a very important question is that there is a tremendous amount of affinity and devotion towards both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden.
Right.
Joe Biden, of course, the beloved and the, you know, the crazy uncle, but also the lovely grandfather for the Democrats. But he is 76 years old, and you know, he ran. You know, they always say that Joe Biden wants to be president in the worst way, and we saw it by the two times he ran for president in 1987 and 2008. They were disasters. But he has served 8 years as a very popular vice president under President Obama. The question is whether he just has the fire in the belly. He doesn't. Look, everybody's saying, why doesn't he announce now? Why doesn't he announce now? I suspect that with the first debates coming up in June, there was really no deadline until then. If he hasn't gotten the race by May, then people could start.
Are you talking about Biden or Sanders?
I'm talking about Biden now, but
yeah.
Sanders again. I mean, look, you're absolutely right. Look at the field. It's younger. It's more women. It's people of color. It's a completely different field than we've ever seen.
Right.
And I'm talking about even though Hillary Clinton made history in 2016, this is so far different with the kind of candidates we're getting. You wonder if maybe 2016 was Bernie Sanders' best shot, and maybe Joe Biden's best shot was in 1918. No, I'm kidding about that. But the fact is, and I know. Look, I love Joe Biden.
Send the mail and the tweets to Ken Rudin.
Carrie Miller.
That's
right.
Ken, good to chat. I'll talk to you next Monday.
Thanks, Carrie.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!